You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Now, the Go Wild app has added some really cool and exciting functionality to their app. And the first one I want to talk about is the Near Me function. And basically what this does, it allows you to engage and connect with people in your area. You guys can talk about gear. You guys can talk about hunting areas. You guys can talk about what's going on in the woods. And it just allows the users to be more of a community and connect easier. The second part is the Gearbox. And what the Gearbox is, it is an opportunity for the users to not only see reviews on products and see what the Go Wild community is using in the field, what products they're using, but it also allows you guys to purchase up to 150,000 products. There's a shopping function on it. So check out the Go Wild app. If you haven't downloaded it to your phone yet, you need to, and you can do that at any app store that is currently available. Go Wild. It's an awesome app. Check them out.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
What's not to love about native landscapes? Guys, we rave on it week after week, month after month, and now year after year. We're almost 240-some podcasts that we've released, and you probably won't go through one podcast or a couple of podcasts in a row. I can almost guarantee that you won't hear us emphasizing the power of natives, whether it be some of our common native weeds, and I air quote that, all the way to diverse prairies and all the benefits that they provide, not only to deer, to pollinators, to quail, turkeys, and even cattle. And there's no better way to kick your land into drive, and there's no better way to jumpstart your habitat restoration on your farm than establishing native landscapes through native grasslands or woodlands or savannas or field edges, whatever it may be, even restoring riparian areas. And there's nobody we like more than Pure Air Natives. They're helping make this podcast possible. That's PureAirNatives.com, PureAirNatives.com. They can do custom blends, CRP mixes, all kinds of stuff when it comes to native forbs and grasses and all other types of native plants. So check them out. All right, welcome back, Land and Legacy Podcast. Adam here. Kyle Hedges joining us once again. It's been a few weeks. Kyle, welcome back.
Yep, thanks to having me back on.
Yeah, so we're right here in the middle of July. Man, if I don't know which is worse, July or August when it comes to summer heat. I'd probably lean more towards August, but some years I'd say July is worse. And so we're right in the heart of battle when it comes to enduring the summer heat. How's the heat been treating you?
Yeah, I hate it. the older I get, anything over 80, I'm ready for October. So,
oh, man, I tell you what, I sit here and I'm on the back porch, by the way, so listeners, you can probably hear some locusts and birds chirping, which has become the new normal, which I think it sounds better than vacant air because at least you know we're outside.
Yep.
But I've always, I always kind of pictured myself never leaving the Ozarks. But I tell you what, the last few years I've been like, boy, it would sure be nice to go through consulting season and everything and then come July and August, preferably probably mid-June to mid-August, get back just in time for fall food plots. But during that two-month window, I'm going to Wyoming or I'm going to Montana. See ya. I'm going to hang out in the mountains for a while. Wouldn't it be nice?
Whew. Yep, agreed.
You usually go west, though. You have been going west to fight fire.
Yep, and of course, where we go, it's hot, but at least there's not the humidity, so
Yeah.
But yeah, that's not going to happen this year. Doesn't look like it.
Is there any wildfires out there?
Oh yeah, they're getting wildfires, but the COVID, you know, fire camps, it's a mess. They can't figure out what to do with people. And they said, if we go, we'd have to come back, you know, you'd be gone for 2.5 weeks and come back, have to be quarantined another 2 weeks. So it turns into a 30-day fire trip, and not looking like it's going to happen.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah.
This COVID stuff is a mess. Wow. Well, so we're right in the middle of summer. And so do you want to kind of kick back, drop us in the middle of a grassland or in your world, what all is going on in the world of wildlife in middle of July for you?
Well, you know, right now this podcast topic kind of popped up in my head because a lot of the habitats that I'm around are really at their peak right now. The native prairies just look awesome. You know, we've got a bunch of wildflowers in bloom, a lot of different color out there in July, late June and July, and we'll have some other stuff coming on here in August. So just some beautiful wildflower displays, pollinators going crazy. You know, quail in the Midwest here are hatching out. They've been hatching for over a month, and they're continuing to have more nests. We have nests that go all, you know, off and on all summer. There really is no end to the nesting season here in Missouri for quail. So really, things are really alive despite the heat. But the interesting part, and what we'll touch on, is how different it is across the country. And not just the heat, but right here in Missouri, we're kind of on the front end of a drought. It's getting pretty bad, pretty dry. And, you know, how that affects some of these species, whether it's deer or quail or prairie chickens, the heat and the drought and cattle and everything else. So
for sure. Yeah, I know this when it comes to this is just a time of the year where so many guys and gals, they head to the woods running trail cameras. It seems like 4th of July is the holiday to celebrate the independence of America, but also to celebrate deer seasons coming quickly. And so trail cameras go out full force after July 4th. And but we seem to kind of forget what's going on right now in the world of habitat and landscapes. And if you really watch, you can see this, I guess the phrase, survival of the fittest, when you get into the summer drought. My farm has missed several rains over the last week and a half, 2 weeks. And as you know, Kyle, here in the Ozarks, you miss 2 weeks of rain, you're looking drought right in the face. And that's kind of how we are. We had several days where it was like 50 and 60% chance of rain, and we didn't get them. And so when that happens and that trend continues, oh, you don't dare want to start that trend and start getting down in that rut of, okay, we got rain coming. Oh, nope, didn't reach us. It seems like every weather pattern that moves through has been either dwindling away by the time it gets to the farm or heading just too far south, just barely missing us, or splitting and kind of going different directions. And it's been just where we're like, all right, I don't want to see this continue. And to a point where I've just even stopped looking because I'm like, it's too depressing. I don't want to see it.
Well, nothing we can do about it either, you know. So
not a thing.
We've been, you know, the drought's part of it, but we've been over 90, which for, you know, South Missouri is, you know, it's July, but we've been over 90 for about 10 days straight. And I looked at the long term, and it's supposed to be above 90 every day until August 9th.
Oof.
So even if you get a couple, you know, quarter inch rains in there, you stay above 90 for a month straight in this part of the world. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to be burned up as far as no growth.
Yep. What is the, I guess you and I both know the answer, and I guess I'll tee it up for you, but a majority of the landscape of the open areas in the Ozarks, what is it?
Yeah, it's cool season non-natives.
Yeah, you've got fescue, orchard grass, those kind of dominating cool season pastures, which even the yards, that always kind of cracks me up. People water their lawns like crazy and it's cool season grass. It's like they're trying to convince it, hey, it's really not that hot. I'm going to give you water and give you water. Please stay green. And it's just like baking. It's like, I can't. I'm not made for this.
Yep. Yeah, so we're starting to see, I mean, obviously Land and Legacy is all about natives, and this is just couldn't be any better example of why natives are important is right now. This, what we go through, drought or no drought, the heat, it's this time of year. This is when natives shine. If you've got cattle, the fescue, our fescue's starting to look like wheat straw, you know, in people's pastures or where people hayed. There's no regrowth on that fescue. We were talking before the podcast about, you know, you mentioned even in the median where they've mowed down the highway right of ways, where it's fescue, it's burned up, it's turning brown, and where there's a few clumps of native, it's 2-3 foot tall, just growing vigorously. So, you know, if you're a cattleman right now, you're not getting any gain out of burned up fescue, but if you got natives, you're putting some weight on your cattle and they're still looking good. But we think about that from a deer standpoint, all the different forages and native. Me personally, I planted food plots like we all do because they're fun, but I don't rely on them. I've got, you know, timber that I've worked. I've got a bunch of natives in fields and timber. The food plots is just a bonus for me. And my dad, my food plots are an hour and a half from here. Planted them. First week of May, went over Memorial weekend, sprayed them, looking good at the time, and sent me pictures yesterday. They haven't changed since Memorial weekend, you know, because they haven't got rained on since I was there. That was May 28th. There's been zero rain on the, I mean, so we just can't rely on that kind of stuff to make your farm, you know?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm still going to have plenty of forage around. The food plot thing is fun, and you like to have that little bit of an extra bump maybe or a little bit of ice cream, but, well, you hit years like this and it doesn't happen, so you
That's
can't
right.
rely on it.
Yeah. That's one of the big things that we've always struggled with, or I guess one thing we've transitioned into when we first started food plots or really started getting into more and more food plots, and then we started planting Roundup Ready crops. It was like, got to get the weeds out. And it was like, man, we got to spray these things out so we can release these beans. But then we realized that, man, we release the beans, but we cook them because there's nothing. They're like just sitting there with nothing. So now it's like, well, let's let all the weeds grow, and then late summer we'll take care of them. And, I mean, mare's tail, which seems like it gets a horrible name, and then common ragweed growing in your food plots. It's like, man, they're torching that right now. Or pokeweed, another big one.
Yep.
And there's another one that I'll mention a little later, for the riparian or kind of cooler areas. But like those growing in your food plots are pretty common. And this time of year, if you are somebody listening somewhere where you have a major amount of heat and dryness, you're probably noticing that this is kind of when they transition to start hammering some of these warm season natives, specifically the annual natives like pokeweed and like common ragweed. And man, that's what they eat, and mare's tail even, just torching them out of the food plots. And so now it's like, okay, no more spraying, we'll just let them eat those while our soybeans try to survive this heat.
Yeah, and you know, we got to have some kind of disturbance to get any of those species. So whether it's you got rank CRP that's, you know, they're not eating the Indian grass and the big blue stem.
Yeah.
That's not doing anything for your turkey poult. So the only place you're going to get a lot of these annuals is where you did a disturbance. So whether it was a burn or whether it was some light disking or whether it was, I mean, obviously in the food plots because there's a disturbance there.
Yep.
That ground you've no-till drilled, even that's a disturbance. So
yep.
There's got to be some level of disturbance to create these plants. But man, you're right. That's what they want right now. And that's where the bugs are at. You know, ragweed grows like crazy in this heat. Well, guess where the turkey poults are at? They're in that because they're certainly not making a living off of picking bugs in a burned up fescue field or in a food plot that the soybeans are all 2 inches tall because they haven't been rained on in 2 months.
And, you know, I wonder if, now this is just an observation and just a guess, but you know how one of the biggest rebuttals people may have with overgrazing is not great for wildlife, and they may say, well, I've got a neighbor who's got a big dairy farm or a cattle farm, and it's loaded with turkeys every year, and he overgrazes the snot out of it. But I always notice that those overgrazed pastures end up having a lot, because of the disturbance that probably got overgrazed, or the disturbance that happened probably when it was overgrazed during the winter months or trampled, that there's a little bit more ragweed component than you would see in some of your other pastures. And I almost wonder if that ragweed is just a crutch for those turkeys during the summer months to you know, grasshoppers are coming in, but still other insects are coming into that ragweed versus, you know, traditional cool season pasture that doesn't quite get as overgrazed. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, me and some other quail guys will laugh about times like this. I mean, if you're a cattleman and you got a bunch of fescue, this is tough, right? Some of these guys are having to start feeding, they're gonna have to start feeding bales just to maintain weight on their cattle, let alone gain weight. So I'm not making light of what heat and drought does to a farmer or a rancher. But from a quail manager standpoint, myself and some of my colleagues, yes, we'll see pastures that all of a sudden a bunch of ragweed comes on midsummer. And I've had farmers, you know, tell me in years like this, dry, hot summers, they're like, man, I saw a covey of quail. I haven't seen a covey of quail in several years, you know, or saw a little brood of quail. And well, yeah. Because finally, there was enough disturbance, and the fescue is so suppressed from the heat and the drought that some weeds were actually allowed to grow.
Yep.
And that attracts bugs. So you're exactly right. I mean, in the quail world here in the Midwest, drought's great.
Yeah.
We get too much rain, our habitat gets too thick, whether it's fescue, even warm season CRP, you know, that doesn't have much forb diversity in it. It's just heavy. Big blue and Indian grass. It gets way too thick if we don't have enough disturbance to grow quail. So a drought year is awesome.
Yeah.
From here east, from Missouri east, we need drought because our habitat gets too thick. We're in 46, 50-inch rainfall country.
Talk on that a little bit more about the difference. You know, whitetail guys, I guess we'll tag team in here. Whitetail guys love wet years. It's like wet spring means large antlers. And then a wet summer means plenty of forage available, food plots look great, and then eliminates the major threat of EHD. So they're just like, deer guys are saying, I wish it'd rain January 1 and it would rain once a week, and we get an inch of rain each week or every other week to where it never really shut off. It was just always cool, warm, or wet to where crops did great. But if that was the case, then you would have very, very bad quail and turkey numbers.
Bingo. Right. So what's good for one isn't good for all in the rainfall world. And it depends on where you're at in the United States. So let's think about a couple things here. The being wet all the time, and we talked about it in the past, you know, for nesting or brood rearing is terrible. If you're a little quail or a pheasant chick, or you get wet, you get hypothermia, the turkey poults, whatever. They can't thermoregulate for the first couple weeks. So if you get wet and you get cold, there's some data out of quail research data out of Tall Timbers down in northern Florida, southern Georgia, that for every quarter inch of rain, they lose 14% of chicks, of broods. Survival goes down 14%, and that's like, you know, less than 3 week old chicks for every quarter inch rain event. So that's not much. I mean, it doesn't matter if it rains 2 inches or a quarter inch, chicks are dying when they're young. So drought's good in this part of the world, but a lot of people get confused. You know, we'll talk about, hey, drought's good for quail, but then you're going to hear, you know, somebody, Dale Rollins out of Texas or somebody in the desert Southwest saying, oh, our quail are terrible this year because it was hot and dry. Well, it's confusing to people. Well, when we move out into, you know, western Kansas, western Oklahoma, high plains of Texas, we get into 20-inch rainfall country. So it's just the opposite. They actually lack enough clumps of vegetation on the ground to adequately have enough nesting locations, and they don't have enough moisture for good weed growth in a dry year. So if they have a drought down there, they get almost very little nesting success and terrible brood rearing conditions. So it's just the opposite. They're praying for rains.
Yeah.
And from us east, we're praying for drought to have better quail, at least this time of year, you know. And even in the heat then is a different factor. We've never documented quail nests basically being baked or poached, the eggs getting poached from the ground temperature. But in Texas, that's actually a problem. When it gets to a certain air temp for enough days, their ground temperature will get so high, and this comes back to not having canopy in plants. You know, it's dry, it's hot, so there may be a clump of vegetation in Texas, and there's 2 feet of sand until the next clump of vegetation. Whereas here, we always have canopy and plants shading the ground, cooling the ground. So they'll actually have eggs that the hens sitting on the eggs, and they'll never hatch. They get cooked from the ground up. And
how long do you think it takes before she realizes they're not going to hatch?
Yeah, I don't know. they'll sit there. I do know they'll sit there for days and days and not know it. I don't know what the extreme is, but I mean, what a complete waste of time and energy, right?
You're
incubating nothing. So it's just so different across the country, and people need to recognize nothing we can do about as far as, you know, the hot and the dry, but just understand that some parts of the country drought's good, some parts of the country drought is terrible, depending on what species we're talking about.
And
you mentioned EHD, sorry, but that, you know, that anywhere out west, deer have more evolved with EHD. They don't have massive die-offs of EHD because it's always dry. From here east, EHD is a big problem in drought years.
Yeah, absolutely. When you think about, I mean, you're going to hear it. You almost always mark my words on this one, but at some point somewhere in the country, you're going to have somebody sweating bullets worrying about EHD. And it very well could be us this year at the family farm, because it could be localized even down to parcels, where I've seen guys, I've seen EHD breakouts where it's like this town and the 20 miles around it got hit. But right the other side of the county, nobody's reporting it at all. And I mean, knock on wood, I've not experienced major EHD kill-offs in my area. We didn't even have that bad in 2012. Now, granted, our deer numbers are so low that it would take a major kill-off for us to really even notice a whole lot. But who knows? Maybe this is our year that we're going to get whacked. I hope not, with some of the deer coming on, but there's going to be somebody out there that gets hit hard probably this summer, because there is such a widespread drought right here in the middle of summer.
You bet. Yep. And my Kansas farm got whacked in 2012, and it takes years to recover from that, from a big EHD die-offs.
Yep. And, you know, that's why we focus so much on holistic management and trying not to focus on one species, because when you do that, let's just say that, you know, you get hit with EHD and you're really focused on just quality deer, and you go through a couple droughts and you go through an EHD kill off, and it's like, I'm 6 years out from really having the quality that I was hoping. Boy, this is, you sing the blues for several years. But if you're managing and you manage from quail and you're going through these droughts, you're like, man, those 2 years it was super dry, our quail population boomed. And it's like, well, yeah, because they're not relying on tons of the what you're hoping for to happen for your deer is not what we're hoping for to happen for the quail and the turkeys.
Yeah, yeah, we need to have the table set. You know, we need to have the habitat for what we're managing for, and hopefully a holistic farm native landscape, right? And these animals will take advantage of that. And when it's a dry year, that's what quail do. They're explosive breeders. Turkey populations can rebound, not as quick as quail, but they'll, you know, boom, boom, a couple of good nesting years and brood rearing years, and you're right back in the game. But if you don't have the habitat in place, and you say, oh, here's the year for, well, it's finally dry, you know, I should be able to have a good quail hatch. Oh, yeah, well, we didn't do anything with our quail habitat for the last 4 years. So you can't recognize those gains. And on the flip side, you know, it doesn't do any good to worry about all the piddly stuff. I can't change the temperature, and I can't make it rain. And this is going to probably offend some people, but you can go put out little kiddie pools all over the timber and spend all your time running water right now to try to keep your deer from having an EHD die off. But I would argue you could spend a lot of time doing a lot of better habitat stuff that would be more beneficial the rest of the year. And I also don't know of any research that's proven that filling little kiddie pools has ever stopped an EHD die off. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely focus on the habitat. You know, one thing I was mentioning earlier too, talked about the native plants and how, in comparison, as much as we love, shoot, the other podcast this week is all about food plots. I mean, we love food plots. We plant a bunch of them, and we recommend a lot of food plots for landowners and our clients. And so we're actively doing it. But as we talked pre-show, how many years have we been like, well, that was a big waste of time. Drought drained it, or it got flooded out. No good. When you work on improving natives, it's like, I can honestly say, I don't know of a time where, whether we planted natives or we did some habitat restoration, where the natives that showed up or started growing have been like a big, like, oh man, that's awful. All that work for restoring the habitat really was just a huge letdown, because there's so many native species that something's going to grow. And maybe I'd be, you know, if you've got any stories, any references here, Kyle, to tell me on a time that you tried to do something to your native landscape and it was a big fail, no. I'd love to hear it.
Nope. And in fact, just the opposite. It's amazing. You just hit on it where it always blows me away. My dad has a little prairie just right next to his house, 3 acres. So it's just, you know, a little pretty spot outside. It's not doing much. We're obviously not managing a bunch of wildlife there, but I mean, he's had quail in there, and of course deer come through there, but it's amazing. I can burn that 1 year, and you know, the start of the summer, there's wild bergamot everywhere, and then the butterfly milkweed just explodes bright orange, you know, in June. And then the next year, maybe not hardly any bergamot. I'll burn it again. It just depends on the year and the rainfall, and there'll be something else that just explodes. The coneflower this year didn't hardly have any bergamot, and there was purple coneflower all over out there. So whatever happened, just a little bit different timing with the burn, or different rain regime after the burn, different temperature. I don't know. It's just God's way of creating diversity over the years, not only within a year, but over the years. And it's just amazing. Every year it's different. Nothing ever looks the same. But that's neat, because it's some years there's certain species that really want certain forbs, right? And they need those. So those insects will flourish more for a year or two. And then for the next 2 or 3 years, it'll be something else. And I don't know. It's just amazing. It's mind blowing, actually, how complicated it all is. But,
for sure. Chad called me today, and, you know, our open hillside we've shared pictures of before on social media and talked about on the podcast, but big woodland and savannah restoration. And I say woodland and savannah like it's the same, and it's not. It just kind of depends on the actual slope for our listeners. Some of the northish facing, northwest facing slopes are more woodland, while our south and west ones are more savanna. So basically, less trees on those sites than the woodland areas. But he called me today and goes, "Well, I found a new one, Royal Catchfly."
Oh, yeah.
I was like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, doing plant surveys when he was working in the Ozarks or Ava District of National Forest Service." Or the U.S. Forest Service, they ID out looking for this one, and he's like, "I found it on the hillside." Well, I can tell you right now, we've never seen it on that hillside. It may have been there in the past, blooming, but I know one thing, we cut and burned, it sure helped it probably do a lot better. And so, yeah, got that one growing. And it's like every single year, last year he found Joe Pye weed, which we don't find a lot. We don't. Chad, Matt, myself around here, you go to Ohio, Kentucky, you probably see it everywhere. But he found it there last year. We found our native honeysuckles. And then also now this one. Then on other site, not too far away, Baldwin's Milk Vine. It's like every single time that we do work on restoring a native landscape or just native habitat enhancement, it's just we're blown away. Where did this plant come from? How long it's set in the soil, or how long has it been there? We just never noticed it, and we gave it some sunlight, we gave it some fire, and it blew up. I'm more blown away by how much further, you know, if my goal or my expectations are a 5 on a scale, it'll turn to a 10. And it's just like, man, but in food plot world, it's like the opposite. I'm expecting a 10 and I get a 5.
Yeah.
Because of drought or too much rain. And it's just like the power of natives. Now, there are some years where you expect a 10 on your food plots and you get a 10. But a lot of the time, regardless of the seed, it's the fact that you're taking a non-native and sticking it into an area and giving it conditions that it's not used to, soil that it's not been adapted to over years and years and years, and you're expecting to have these amazing results. Now, you get good results, but some years you're going to have major failures. And natives are almost always, I shouldn't say it like that, but natives are more fail-proof than non-natives.
Well, absolutely. They're supposed to be here. God put them here. So
yeah.
It's funny how that works. Like, oh, it's a dry year? Well, these 49 species will thrive. Oh, it's a wet year? These 83 species will thrive.
Yeah.
And they all live in the same, you know, acre.
Yeah.
Because that's how it was all designed.
Yeah. I know
you're a plant nerd, but I'm going to join in. That Royal Catchfly, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
I have 22,000, my day job as a state biologist, I manage 22,000 acres, and I only have one site that has that plant on it, Royal Catchfly. So that's a big deal.
That's
a rare one.
Yeah. And so, you know, we've got some clients, man, some young guys too, that, you know, you meet them on the street, you meet them at hunting, sporting goods store. Probably wouldn't expect them to be this way, but they're like, their goal is to find rare plants on their farm now. So they're doing all this stuff. And so Royal Catchfly is, the Baldwin's Milk Vine was really cool for us. When I pulled it up on USDA site, it was like, this is not in our county, it says. Oh, okay. And it takes a very specific site. And so Royal Catchfly on one of the apps we use, not in our region very much, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Going
that
to
stuff sells for like $100 an ounce for the seed.
Oh man, we're gonna be commercial growers of Royal Catchfly.
Yeah.
Oh man, well one of the more common ones that probably doesn't sell for $100 an ounce, probably more like $5 for a pound. And I don't even know. I know harvesting the seed would be pretty cool, but When I think of like the summer heat, and you can just picture soybeans with the leaves turned up. They're just trying to survive it. You can picture your perennial clover kind of going dormant, not looking so hot. But I picture during July and August, I picture jewel weed going absolutely nuts. That's yep. one of my favorites for those cool those cooler areas along creeks that just get devoured by deer.
Yep. So there you go. Once again, I'm sure by design. So that's a drought proof. Yep. Grow in the lower environments and deer love it. So
yep.
There's just, you manage all these habitats. And I would even go as far as saying, you know, it depends on the size of the farm, but most of the plans that, you know, we're writing for people that it's great if they can do everything that, you know, the sooner they do stuff, the sooner they're seeing the results. But I like to go into, you know, if you're talking about a, say 200 acres of timber and we're going to do some thinning and burning, I don't want to do it all in one shot because you'll get such a different response. So it diversifies even within that, you know, if you do a 50 acre block, thin. Obviously, if you're having a timber sale, where you're going to do the whole thing to some level. But if we're going to do some more thin and do a 50-acre block and next year do another 50-acre block of TSI, you'll get completely different results sometimes.
Yeah.
Because of the weather patterns that followed. Same as different results from each year of burning. So.
And if you did your, you know, you did your disturbance, your thinning during the summer one year and did it during the winter the other year, you're going to have a different plant yep. response because of that. Just like with dormant season disking versus or yep. fire would be a better analogy. If you're burning during the summer versus burning in February, you're going to see different plant communities respond.
Yep. So you get all this diversity and man, we're really setting the table for all these different species. Somebody's going to thrive.
For sure. For sure. Talk a little bit about thermal cover for nesting birds during the heat.
Yeah, so, you know, when you've got, let's take prairie chickens, for example. People will think about prairie chickens being in this wide open spaces, which for the most part they are. But even them, you know, when it gets really hot in western Nebraska, western Kansas, western Oklahoma, they've got to get those broods into some thickets. So they'll actually use thickets, plum thickets and sumac thickets for thermal cover. So they can get in there. They want the no grass understory. I mean, just standing on bare dirt, you get a breeze coming through there and it can be, you know, 20 degrees cooler standing in there than out in the direct sun, even in the vegetation. So it's really important for, of course, quail do the same thing. And deer, if we know that it's a stressful time of year for deer. And so if you've got those places where they can get some shade with some airflow, man, they already got enough stress, you know, as it is dealing with tick loading and everything else that comes with everything I hate about summer. So that's when thickets shine, another native, you know, native thickets, plums and dogwoods and sumacs around here. You know, whether it's mesquite, whatever, there's places that animals got to get in the shade this time of year to cool off.
Yeah. Even willows in those little coulees.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. I think because sometimes we lock ourselves in the AC, during the summer months that it's kind of like outside, out of mind. Like if you go out, that's one of the big things about, you know, when we work down in the South, we try to get that done in the winter, or early spring, and not try to go to Texas in June like I did. But that's just the way it yep. worked out this year. And it's like, yeah, it's hot as heck down here right now. And it's only June. We still got July, August, September, sometimes October to get through it. Like, there's a lot of, you really have to focus on the power of natives to make this work. Because it would be tough to live here 365. And thermal cover, man, gets so talked about in the north, but it's just as important for critters in the summer months, especially in the south.
Yep, you bet. I mean, like I said, it's just a brutal time of year. So, and they'll use, you know, ground nesting birds are going to use that same thicket during those rainstorms as well. The shape of a plum thicket, and now they're leafed out this time of year. It's going to shed some water. The hen will, you know, stretch her wings over her chicks best she can and cover them. So it's important for a lot of reasons. When we finally do break the drought cycle and get the rainstorm, or when it's that hot middle of the day time, we just got to have all this combination of stuff that should be out here. Plants that canopy giant ragweed. I mean, what a great plant we've talked about a bunch of times. Common ragweed, giant ragweed. But think about, you know, little quail chicks or turkey poults right now that can stand under a giant ragweed that's the plant's 5 foot tall this time of year and got giant leaves, but at the ground it's level, it's bare ground. And so you can stand there picking bugs off the stem and you're in the shade because of the big leaves over your head, and a hawk can't see you either. So you're kind of hidden and you're shaded. So just a lot of different native annuals and native shrubs that can really save our bacon in this kind of weather this time of year.
Yep, for sure. I know. So Matt and I did a podcast probably a month ago about surviving the heat. It was devoted to mainly whitetails. Now we're talking overall land and kind of reining in on birds, game birds especially. And, you know, it's just, it's important to understand that I think one of the big takeaways in this, I know we probably said it before, I know we have, but it's like, just because it's hot and dry doesn't mean it's terrible for all wildlife.
That's exactly right. Yep. Depends on where you're at.
Yeah. And so, you know, if your farm is dominated by non-natives, you're going to find out that, ooh, some of those really don't like the heat, unless it's Johnson grass. So I got to ask, man, I just got to ask. We released a podcast last week that was The Things We Wish Were True, and it was a very non-research-based podcast. I believe wholeheartedly that most of our podcasts, we really try to follow some of the key researchers in the world of whitetails and land and habitat ecology, just trying to figure out and understand their research and then rein it in for our clients and our listeners. But that podcast was not. That was kind of like, you know, how do we motivate people or get people to do more for habitat? Well, I know one way we could make it happen. Tell them that this is true. It's just like the midges on cedar needles. It's like, yeah. Where people talk about EHD breakouts being the worst is Iowa, northern Missouri, Illinois. And it's like, well, you've got monster areas or big thickets of cedar trees. And it's like, get rid of those stinking things. They're a waste of land. And it's like, well, if you told them that midges were attracted to those, they'd go and cut every one of them down yesterday. So for you listening to that, I think a one that came to mind for me, but was like, I wish that it was true that farmers feared fescue like they fear a Johnson grass patch that they fertilized hard and then it took a major turn and got a major drought.
Mm-hmm.
They fear
Here's what I was thinking on the quail world for my sake. If we could just spread the story that coronavirus is breeding in fescue.
Yes.
How about that? And then everybody just gets rid of their fescue, solves the coronavirus problem, and next thing you know, we got quail in the Midwest.
Well, that would be awesome, but I think now we're dealing with so many people. Now coronavirus is water off a duck's back. Most people are like, whatever. I don't believe any of it now.
It's like, it's old hat. It's like the boy who cried wolf, right? They've heard it, and they don't know anybody that got it, so they're like, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. If there's some way to get people to feel like fescue is bad. Actually, we should tell one part of the world that Monsanto is who came out with fescue.
There you go.
Yeah. It's just we got a long road, tough road to hoe, as they say. But when it comes to native landscapes and surviving the heat, that's what this podcast is about, surviving the heat. I think there's a couple takeaways, one of them being, you know, just because it's hot doesn't mean it's all bad. So just try to appreciate it for what it is and know that, yeah, it might not be ideal for one of the species that you're focused on. It might be really good for a species that you would like to see come back. So let's just say you've got a small covey that you've seen on the farm, and it's like, well, we're kind of here, as you mentioned pre-show, that we're kind of right in the middle of nesting season for bobwhite quail here in the Midwest. And so even though it is hot and it's dry, at least they're not getting rained out and getting flooded out. So you may see a few more quail next year. Who knows? But at the same time, it's not always best to manage your land when you're always singing the blues.
Yep, that's right. And we just got to set the table. We just got to prepare our farms as best we can. And natives are what does that. So if we can be diverse and have natives, then as weather patterns change every year and we get a wet year and a cool year and a hot year and a dry year, we're going to see different things flourish. And that's how it was historically. I like to consider it or call it managed chaos. As a biologist, I'm just trying to kind of replicate what God put into play, which was chaos. And disturbances came and went and temperatures changed. And that's just how it's always been. But we've altered the landscape so much that the plants aren't there to deal with the situations that we get thrown from the climate anymore. So we got to restore those plants, and the climate will keep doing its thing.
For sure. Well, if you got any closing thoughts, we'll wrap it up, and hopefully some guys will get out and take this podcast to heart and kind of sit back and just realize, okay, you know, 2020 has been it's been a year, hasn't it?
Yes.
It's just,
you can say that.
I don't know how to even say it anymore. It's just, wow, what a year it's been. 2020, let's close it out. Let's try to put the first 7 months behind us and work on, there's always work to do for the habitat. Doesn't matter if it's middle of deer season, there's some amazing stuff you can do to promote the habitat. And really get back and say, okay, next year I'm going to fix this place to where I feel much better going into a drought, that there's still plenty available for the wildlife.
Yep. It's times like this people need to get out. I know it's hot, it's miserable. Go out early, but go look at your farm. You need to be looking at your farm, you know, every season. I would argue every month of the year. Get out and look as much as you can and kind of take some notes on what's going on and what you think is missing and lacking. And if you're in a drought place that you haven't, you know, right now, drier times than you have been for several years, you might realize, I need to fix this, that, and make a list of things to work on during the winter months or whenever you're going to get to it. So the next time we have a hot, dry summer, you're not saying, oh, yep, right back to the same situation. No, I fixed some of those problems. I added those plum thickets, or, you know, I got more natives. I've got some annuals. I got ragweed out here. I got some of these foods that I want to have. So
absolutely,
there's ways to fix it. You just got to identify it and start making plans to do it.
There you go. Couldn't said it better myself. Guys, gals, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Yeah.